The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
I'm Nina Porzucchi, and this is The World in Words, a podcast about languages and the people who speak them. So, our story starts in 1994, when a meerkat, a warthog, and a lion had a conversation. This is not a joke.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata?
Yeah, it's our motto.
What's the motto?
Nothing. What's the motto with you?
This lion was in a bad mood, and the meerkat and warthog wanted to cheer him up. So they told him Hakuna Matata, which means...
It means no worries. Hakuna Matata.
No worries.
No worries.
No worries. The lion, of course, was Simba from The Lion King. His friends were Timon and Pumbaa. And to tell us more about The Lion King, and more importantly, about the language that it borrows from, is reporter Daniel Gross. Hey, Daniel.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi.
To our humble home.
Hakuna Matata.
Right, Hakuna Matata, which means no worries. Specifically, it means no worries in Swahili. And it's just one of many Swahili words that have become international. Simba is the Swahili word for lion, and Pumbaa is the Swahili word for warthog. This, by the way, is what Swahili sounds like. Swahili, which is known as Kiswahili in East Africa, has its roots in a small tribal language spoken along one little strip of Africa's eastern coastline. But these days, it's the king of African languages.
Pun intended.
And it's spoken by more people than Korean or Italian. And Swahili has even made it to the United States.
Yeah, with the help from the likes of Walt Disney. Swahili has become a pan-African lingua franca that for a lot of people represents unity and freedom. Today on the podcast, the story of how it got that way.
See on your door, you have a map of Africa.
Yes, I have Africa, States, and Europe.
I'm standing in a nondescript office at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, and I'm looking at a map of Africa with Professor Alden Mutembe. He's walking me through all the countries where you can find people speaking Swahili, starting with Tanzania and Kenya, where it's a mother tongue. And we are here in the central eastern portion of Africa in Tanzania.
In East Africa, you have Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. Now you have Southern Sudan joining the East Africa. All this area speaks Swahili.
I should add that in each of these places, Swahili is used in different ways. At home, at school, at your local corner store. In Kenya, people speak Swahili at home, but street signs and advertisements are in English. And in Tanzania, Swahili is used on street signs and at home. Anyway, back to Mutembe and the map of Africa.
The southern part of Somalia speaks Swahili. This part of Ethiopia speaks Swahili. Southern Sudan, Central Africa, DRC.
Then there are all the countries where Swahili isn't widely spoken, but where it's taught in schools. The list goes on and on. Angola, Zambia, Mozambique, Malawi. In Zimbabwe, Swahili is mandatory.
If you go to West Africa, you have Nigeria.
You've covered almost the entire continent now, with the exception of a few Arabic-speaking countries in the north.
For your information, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, supported Swahili.
So it's pretty clear that Swahili has transformed from the language of one tribe to the language of a whole continent.
Today, we have about 100 million speakers.
100 million speakers, with more on the way. So to explain that transformation, we have to rewind the clock almost 100 years. Most of Africa was colonized by Europeans back then, and East Africa was no different. The British were in modern-day Kenya, and the Germans were in modern-day Tanzania. And in what's now Tanzania, German missionaries adopted Swahili. The problem was, it was written in an Arabic script. Most Europeans couldn't read it.
It was under the German Kaiser, the German chief, the German king, who ordered that Swahili should now change from Arabic scripts to Roman scripts.
Swahili became the official language of Germany's East African colony. One of the earliest books to migrate from German into Swahili was the Bible. But then came World War I, which ended with Germany losing all of its colonies. Britain took over Tanzania. And in their new colonial holdings, what's now Kenya and Tanzania, locals spoke lots of languages in this Bantu language family. Those are languages spoken across most of Africa. But the British were looking for a common language across its new territories. And one language straddled Kenya and Tanzania. That was Swahili. So here, the British pick up the baton of Swahili linguistics.
What they did, which is they should get the credit, they started structuring.
They decided to standardize one particular dialect, Unguja, which was spoken on the tropical island of Zanzibar, part of Tanzania.
And from that time, 1930, Swahili expanded. And it was the official language of the colonial government.
To this day, Swahili bears the imprint of those early efforts to standardize and spread the language. Because the main dialect comes from Zanzibar, there's a special pride there. Just as some Brits take pride in their English, Zanzibaris take pride in their Swahili.
When people from Zanzibar speak, they say this is a pure language. And in Swahili, we have two words, standard and correct. They say Kiswahili fasaha, correct language, as opposed to Kiswahili sanifu, standard language. So you can see that hierarchy. They still feel that is their Swahili.
Zanzibaris are proud of their dialect, but at the same time, Britain raised the profile of Swahili by giving it official status across all of its territory. So this one dialect became more than just a local vernacular.
It does not belong to somewhere. It does not belong to any tribe or any country, so to speak.
I asked Mutembe if he was proud of Swahili, and he said yes, but he also told me that Swahili is not his mother tongue. He grew up in a village where everyone spoke Haya. Back then, Swahili was like the language of the big city.
When you speak Swahili, you are like somebody who has been enlightened, you know, somebody coming from the urban, somebody who knows a lot of things and so on. So it was exciting, actually, to learn Swahili. And going back home in my village, speak Swahili, oh, wow, he's from the town. I mean, he's enlightened. He knows a lot of things and so on. In those days, learning Swahili and speaking Swahili, you feel, wow, yes, I'm somebody, yeah.
In the late 1970s, Mutembe was hungry to learn a language that symbolized the wider world, even in the face of huge obstacles.
That was also during the time of the war against Uganda against Tanzania. Bad times, eating once a day, and there was no this and that and so on.
How did you manage to study during a war when you can't find food to eat?
It was not easy. Studying was not easy because there were very few teachers. So some of us who were working hard would learn, in the evening until late. And there was no electricity, no power at all. So we were using either candle or a kerosene lamp and so on.
Professor Mutembe still feels lucky that he got to learn Swahili, which is one reason that he devoted his career to helping others learn the language. So that map of Africa that Mutembe showed me, we started in East Africa near the Horn. Now we're going to travel all the way across that map to Namibia, thousands of miles away in southern Africa. F.E.M.K. Senkoro teaches Swahili in Namibia. He's not from there, he's from Tanzania, and he's come all this way because he wants to spread Swahili across Africa. He believes it has the power to bring Africans together.
It symbolizes freedom. It symbolizes Africanness, being African. It's a language that has a very, very bright future as a unifying factor in Africa.
Given that Swahili was standardized in part by missionaries, it's fitting that Senkoro has carried the language to a country so far away, with the kind of dedication you'd expect from a missionary. He says far-flung African countries are eager to learn.
We did not even have to push it. It pushed itself. It's the people. Actually, it was pulled. We didn't push it. It was pulled by the people themselves.
One of the reasons that so many people have pulled this language all across Africa is that Swahili feels familiar. Remember, Swahili is part of the Bantu language family. So similar languages are spoken across a huge swath of the continent.
All these languages are somehow related to Kiswahili. So it people discover words and expressions and grammar that is similar to their languages. Even counting the numbers, that's how we say it. That's how we say it in our language. That's how we say it. You know, things of that type.
That is why Sankoro thinks that this language can unify the continent.
Because it has all the qualities that are needed, including we have intellectualized it, the dictionaries, so many dictionaries, books and so on, and programs and everything, and the internet. So
for a language to be a lingua franca, I guess it needs to work at many levels. It needs to work with a shopkeeper, and it also needs to work with a professor.
Exactly.
And everywhere in between.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why that's what this language is doing right now. If I were a Kenyan leader, I would really build on Kiswahili, depend on Kiswahili, to kill that idea of the tribe.
But isn't that a tricky decision to make? Because so many tribal languages and so many local languages have been undermined by colonial languages, by German and Afrikaans and English. Wouldn't it be a risky move to do the same thing with Swahili?
I think it would be better to undermine these languages by using their fellow language. But personally, if you ask for my honest opinion, I don't care if they die. You know, if Kiswahili were to survive or to triumph, and the other languages were to die because of Kiswahili, I wouldn't mind. For me, that would be a plus. It would be a victory of Africa.
This is where Sankoro and Mutembe start to disagree. See, for Sankoro, unity across the continent is more important than tribal identity. But for Mutembe back in Tanzania, it's kind of a tragic thought. He still loves his tribal language of Haya.
As a matter of fact, I feel a pity that my kid will not get this language. So I started writing a grammar, a Haya grammar book, slowly, trying to teach the kids about some Haya words. But it's a language that naturally will be dying because it's not used anywhere.
As Swahili has expanded into countries that never used to speak it, it's turned into something like a movement, advanced by people like Sankoro and Mutembe. During the apartheid era in South Africa, liberation fighters in exile learned Swahili. And recently, it became an official language of the African Union. It even spread outside of Africa.
You remember the late Michael Jackson had some Swahili words in his song, Liberian Girl. You know the song? Liberian Girl. It is it's a very popular song, but an old one. But in this song, you have Swahili words. Nakupenda pia, nakutaka pia, mpenzi we. I like you, I love you, my lover.
So how do Swahili words migrate from East Africa across the continent and then into the song of an African-American pop singer? There are a few clues in Michael Jackson's song. First, geography. Liberia is on the west coast of Africa. Swahili is mostly spoken in East Africa. And that female voice you heard belongs to Leta Mbulu from South Africa. So there's something eclectic going on here. On the other hand, Liberia and Swahili do have something in common. See, Liberia was founded by African Americans who still felt a link to the continent their ancestors came from. And as we heard from Mutembe and Sankoro, Swahili embodies that feeling of connection to the continent, to Africa. So it seems like this is a song that's not just African American, but also Pan-African. It's not about the differences between East Africa, South Africa, and West Africa. It's interested in what's shared between different African identities. Michael Jackson, of course, is not the only American who's been drawn to Swahili. And here I want to introduce you to Leija Farr, a college student from Seattle, Far loves the holiday season.
Most people are excited about Christmas, but I'm always excited about the day after, which is Kwanzaa.
This year will mark the 50th anniversary of the first Kwanzaa, which itself is a Swahili word. It means first, referring to the first fruits of the harvest. It's a holiday invented by an African studies professor named Maulana Karenga, and it was meant to foster that same sense of pan-African pride.
Well, I first started learning Swahili through Kwanzaa. We say jambo, which means hello. If you're asking somebody what's the Kwanzaa day, you would say abargani, which means what's the news, and then they say the day. Kwanzaa is 7 days. Umoja, Kuji Chagalia, Ujima, Ujamba, Nia Kuumba, Nimani. And all those days mean something in Swahili.
Far lives almost 10,000 miles from Tanzania. And even though her parents don't know too much about their roots in Africa, Kwanzaa and Swahili helped her bridge the distance. She learned about both from her dad.
He just always felt a certain connection to Africa. You know, Seattle, as it already is, we have a very low African-American population. And I think that Kwanzaa is kind of like the epicenter of blackness. It's just rich with blackness. And I just love that about it because it's sort of like our Mecca in Seattle.
4 years ago, Far was at school when she started singing a song from her childhood, a song that helped her learn Swahili in the first place. She didn't expect anyone to understand it, but one young woman named Ilhan did.
It's kind of like a beginner's into Swahili song. I was singing one of those. It goes, Jambo, Jambo Bwana, Habari Gani, Mzuri Sana, Wageni, Wakaribishwa, Kenya Yetu, Hakuna Matata. And she heard me singing that, and she was like, how do you know that song? And she was like, oh, so you know Swahili? And I was like, yeah. I said certain words to her, and she was like, oh, yeah, I'm from Kenya. You know, I speak Swahili.
All those thousands of miles from home, Ilhan was hearing her own language sung by an American teenager, which is a pretty unlikely journey. And Far's friendship with Ilhan has led to some goofy learning experiences.
I remember one time I had candy, and it was Mambas, and I was asking her, does she want a Mamba? And she was like, what? And I was like, do you want a Mamba? And she was like, do you know what that means in Swahili? I was like, no. She was like, oh, it means alligator. So that was funny because she thought I was asking her, does she want an alligator?
For a lot of people, a language is like a home. It's a sense of belonging. Far has never taken a class in Swahili, and it isn't a language she gets to speak very often. She's never been to East Africa. But every time Kwanzaa rolls around, the holiday and the language feel to her like a second home. And she says in Seattle, the community is growing.
They're really enticed by being a part of something that is so black and is so willing to accept them, especially in a society where they don't feel accepted. Kiswahili is such a welcoming language. I just think it's so much love around the language.
To know that Swahili has taken root so far from Tanzania would make Mutembe and Sankoro very proud. Both of them have spent time teaching in North America. And Sankoro even remembers how surprised he was to bump into a Swahili speaker outside of Africa.
I was at a bus stop and I was waiting for a bus. And this old lady said she had lived in Tanzania in Kilimanjaro. And we tried our Kiswahili and so on. And it was fun. It was nice. Very, very nice, actually.
Thanks so much, Daniel, for coming and sharing your story today.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I wanted to give a shout out to Swahili Nation. This is their song, Hakuna Matata, playing in the background.
No worries. How can people reach you, Daniel, if they want to tweet at you?
They can find me on Twitter at ReadWriteRadio.
And you can always tweet Patrick and me. Patrick and me, I got corrected last time for saying Patrick and I. Patrick and me at LingoPod. Thank you all those grammarians listening out there. And thanks to everyone for listening.
World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.